Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad to be here. I've been battling the sinus infection curse of disease all weekend, but I think today I'm going to make it because I love doing this program and being with you. I want to say today, Monday, October 5th, happy anniversary, dear wife, Becky, dear life partner and best friend. We've been married today 14 years. And I remember last time, 14 years ago, we were in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, at a wonderful, beautiful escape location for our honeymoon. And it was right at the same time when we invaded Afghanistan. This was right after the 9/11 tragedies. I'll never forget these events for the rest of my life. I remember when 9/11 happened, Becky and I looked at each other and said, are we really going to get married? I mean, with all that's happening in the world, and we did. And 14 years later, here we are, and very happy to be together. And I want to say that if you are married and you have a special anniversary, do not forget to take your special spouse out on a wonderful date and be with them and talk with them and just have a wonderful time together. Celebrate your life together, because as we found out this past weekend, your life is like a vapor. And life, which we celebrate right now, can so quickly be taken from us. It seems like that there is no place safe anymore. And of course, I'm talking about the horrible, horrific tragedy in Oregon with the 9 Christians that lost their lives this weekend standing up for their faith. When the gunman said, do you believe in God? What is your religion? Are you a Christian? And they stood up and were shot and killed on the spot. A horrific tragedy that seems to be a continued pattern. It seems that there's only a few days, a week, and all of a sudden here we go again. You know, in the church, in the university. It seems like that no place is safe anymore. Well, this morning, what I want to do on this very, very special day of my anniversary is to celebrate life with you and to remember these 9 precious lives dedicated to Christ that were unafraid to stand up and were given no mercy. And this maniac shot a woman in a wheelchair. I can't even say his name. I won't do him the honor for the way he treated humanity. What I want to do, though, is I want to recognize these 9 victims and those that were shot and injured that are thankfully still alive. I want to recognize everyone today and dedicate this program to you. You and I are alive today. We have an opportunity to do something good and wonderful for humanity, for our fellow American citizens, for our Afghan friends, for our Iranian friends, whoever they may be. We have an opportunity today to impact the lives of other people with our love, with our prayers, with our hard work for their human rights. And I say that because these 9 victims were simply working hard at their own profession, at their own education to make a difference in the world. And someone who thought he could play God took their lives. How quickly our lives can be taken. So let's dedicate them today for the glory of God. I want to start with the news report as it unfolded during this very, very tragic day. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
We begin tonight with a deadly campus shooting. This evening, authorities confirming multiple deaths after a mass shooting at a quiet community college south of Portland, Oregon. The gunman opening fire in multiple classrooms, several dead, at least 20 injured. As you heard the president speaking moments ago, saying another community stunned with grief. That campus on lockdown, SWAT teams on the scene at this hour. The emotional reunions, a close-knit community now reeling. The aerial pictures coming in at this hour, bomb-sniffing dogs there in the parking lot, the FBI now on the scene. And word coming in, the gunman, a 20-year-old male, was killed after exchanging gunfire with authorities. ABC's Neil Karlinski in Oregon tonight, leading us off.
10:30 a.m., the frantic calls started coming in, an active shooter on the rural Oregon campus.
Copy, active shooter, UCC, 1140 Umpqua College Road.
Within minutes, students inside Umpqua Community College were tweeting their terror. Oh my God, there's someone shooting on campus, tweeted one. Students are running everywhere. Holy God.
The teacher came running in and only told us to get inside the teacher's office and get down as fast as we could and drop everything.
It must be terrifying.
Oh, it was. It was horrifying. And being locked in there and not knowing if my friends were okay, I, of course, was bawling my eyes out.
1174, medical aid. This is for an active shooter at UCC.
Emergency vehicles flooded the scene. Radio traffic indicates the shooter was still firing.
This is going to be the Snyder Hall. Somebody is outside one of the doors, shooting through the door.
Amber Adams is a student at the school.
Shots were being fired. We heard shots and immediately took cover, went down, and heard just multiple shots going off, a lot of screaming.
Lori Reisner, another student, describes chaos.
A lady just went running by me crying, saying that there's an active shooter on campus. Everybody get into this hallway.
Authorities tonight saying the 20-year-old male shooter engaged in a shootout with police before being shot dead.
Code 4, suspect is down.
Our number one priority right now is to make sure that the scene is secure and the victims are treated and that we continue to make sure that there are no additional threats.
Students could be seen being let out of the school, their bags being checked by police, canine units sweeping the campus, investigators establishing crime scenes. The college of about 3,000 students is in a rural area about 180 miles south of Portland, and it took some time for emergency officials to make sense of the scope of the carnage. Tonight, the Douglas County Sheriff saying there are 10 confirmed fatalities and 7 additional injuries. The injured arrive on stretchers.
The work that first responders have done is harrowing.
On the campus, students hugging, scenes of incredible grief.
In the coming days, we'll learn about the victims. Young men and women who were studying and learning and working hard, their eyes set on the future, their dreams on what they could make of their lives. And America will wrap everyone who's grieving with our prayers and our love.
This is a town in grieving tonight. The scene of the shooting is just a few short blocks from here. Again, the shooter is described as a 20-year-old male. He was a student at the school, and we expect to learn a lot more about him in the hours and days ahead. David.
Neil Karlinski will stay on the scene throughout the night, and as you heard from the president, this is the 16th time he's come before the cameras after a mass shooting. And ABC senior justice correspondent Pierre Thomas, live in our Washington bureau tonight. Pierre, we know there's a large group of federal agents heading to the scene at this hour.
That's right, David. Scores of federal agents from the FBI, U.S. Marshals, and ATF are now on the scene. Law enforcement sources say they believe they have identified the shooter and they have begun an extensive background investigation into his life. They say he left behind messages. There's no known nexus to international terrorism at this point. Our sources tell us 4 firearms were found at the scene, 3 pistols and an assault rifle.
Just horrific how this unfolds from schools to universities to churches. It seems, as I've mentioned, no place seems to be safe anymore. People sometimes are afraid to even go to their own movie theater. From the movie theater to the church to the school to the university, where is it that we as human beings are safe? And it makes you think that when you go out on your daily routine, you just never know with these definitely mentally ill, demon-possessed people, I would say, that are on the rampage. They want to kill people. They enjoy death more than they enjoy life. One of the shooting victims who was rushed into surgery apparently confirmed what we've been hearing in the news, that this individual seemed to be targeting Christians, and she recounted how he actually called them out and made them stand. We're going to hear right now from her father right now on the cross in the desert.
Injuries. We met the father and brother of one of the victims, an 18-year-old. Her name is Anna Boylan. It was her 4th day of school at community college, and she says that she, before she went into surgery, told her father and brother that she was sitting in class like she normally does. The gunman came in with his gun blazing. Here's what she told her father and brother.
Sociologist.
No problem.
The gentleman was systematically.
So he came in, right?
He came in, and there were gunfire immediately and scattered the room, got everyone's attention. He, from what I understood, what she said is he shot the professor point blank, right? One shot killed him, took him right out of it. And others had been injured. And then this man had enough time. I don't know how much time elapsed before he was able to stand there and start asking people one by one what their religion was. Are you a Christian? He would ask them. And if you're a Christian, stand up. And they would stand up, and he said, good, because you're a Christian, you're going to see God in just about 1 second. And then he shot and killed them. And he kept going down the line doing this to people. And how much time do you need? You know, and she said he had a handgun. It wasn't a big rifle, assault rifle, or anything like this. This was a single handgun that he had enough ammunition and enough time to drop the magazine out of it, put another one in, and continue his thing. How does he have that much time at a facility? I mean, Dad, you're okay.
I don't understand that.
How he could have that much time to kill that many people.
All of these young and middle-aged and older victims bravely took their stand for Jesus that day and were not aware that it would be the final thing they would do. And I can't picture this. I'm trying to visualize as he describes this. It happened so very quickly. And probably most people were still in shock from the shooting of the professor. And we're really trying to categorize what is going on here. It happened so quickly. But like the father said, he took the time to call out those who were Christians and ask them to stand. There was one hero, one specific hero among many. He was one, Christopher Mintz, who took several bullets, stopped this man from shooting many more people and killing them. And there was recently an interview with his aunt, about her nephew and the incredible thing he did to stop other people from being killed. Let's listen to that interview right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Up front tonight for an exclusive interview, Chris Mintz's aunt, Angela Galvin. And Angela, thank you so much for being with us in this horrible, horrible story. There is this one story of heroism that is so inspiring. That is your nephew. He was shot 7 times. How is he doing tonight?
He's in a lot of pain. He's had a lot of people want to talk to him, but he's in so much pain, he's just not comfortable talking right now.
I spoke briefly to your brother, Chris's dad. He said that they're going to have to perhaps operate on his hand. He had been shot in the stomach, in the back. Do they know at all what's next for him?
We know that there's possibly some more surgeries, but we also know that there's a lot of rehabilitation that's going to have to take place. It broke both of his legs. He was shot in both legs, and he had to put rods in. And so he's going to have extensive rehabilitation for that. Also, his hand was shot, so we don't know what all the damage is for that. He also was hit in the back with a bullet that traveled down his side and into his hip, which they decided to leave that bullet in his hip. So we just know that it's going to be a lot of rehabilitation, a lot of recovery, and he's suffering a lot with some pain.
I mean, he's suffering, and he is someone who put his life on the line to save others. When he heard the gunshots, he ran, but he ran towards the gunman, so that the gunman would stop shooting others. I mean, you know, most people hear that, and it is something almost no one can comprehend actually doing. He did it. Does this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me at all. Chris was also shot in the abdomen, which, you know, is also dangerous. We worry about infection for that. But it doesn't surprise me what Chris did. Growing up, Chris was always a very active, rambunctious little boy, and he thought he was invincible. He always thought that, you know, nothing could hurt him. So the fact that he did that doesn't surprise me at all. I'm just very pleased and blessed, our whole family is, that he survived.
And his father, your brother, when I was talking to him on the phone, told me that Chris was there in school to become a physical therapist to help people who were handicapped.
Yeah, Chris is very physically, you know, he does a lot of weightlifting, he eats right, he's very healthy. But I think one of the things that has turned him towards that is he has a son that has autism, and Chris is very hands-on as a father and helping take care of his son. So that, I think, made him want to help people, especially mental retardation and other things, because Chris is doing that already, and he stepped up, he manned up, and he's been a great father.
And it was his son. It was his 6th birthday yesterday, and he told the shooter that. He told him that it was his son's 6th mm-hmm. birthday. Why do you think it was so important for him to say that at that moment?
I think he wanted, I'm not sure if he was trying to tell him, you know, don't do this to me on this day, you know, it's my son's birthday. I'm not sure if that's what he meant, but that's what I would assume that he meant, you know, don't, because somebody had said that he told him, it's my son's birthday, man, don't do this. So I'm imagining that's what it was. But he was also one of the people that were trying to help him before the paramedics got there. Said that he kept saying it over and over, it's my son's birthday, it's my son's birthday.
A love for his son. And I know your brother is going to be leaving in the morning, your family's together tonight, leaving in the morning, driving across the country to stay as long as it takes to help Chris get better. But it's going to be, as you said, Angela, such a long recovery. Your family set up a GoFundMe page to help Chris. What do you need?
Well, he's going to obviously need living expenses. He'll need help with rehabilitation. Fortunately, we have a great family also.
And how is Chris's little son, who's now 6?
You know, since he has autism, he can't speak, so we've not spoken with him. But from what we've heard from his mother, he's okay. He's being taken care of. Her family has come up to help support her in this and to help support Chris. So we're glad for that.
Just an incredible story, a bright spot in this tragedy. Christopher Mintz had no fear. He did what he knew he had to do to stop this madman. He nearly paid for his life with it. But the first and uppermost thing in this man's mind, which makes him a hero, is he was thinking of other people. He was thinking of what their lives would be like. He was not just thinking of himself and his son's birthday. He was thinking of the lives of others. And I would say that what Chris did to this gunman would most definitely stop him. He stopped him from shooting others and instead took the bullets that were intended for others. And we would have more than 9 or 10 victims. We would have more than that had it not been for Chris Mintz. God bless you, Chris, for your self-sacrifice. There are no words to say how we are so grateful for you. And yes, GoFundMe. Let's make sure that this individual doesn't have one bill, that we take care of people that love us to the extent of giving their lives for us, that we show our appreciation to this man. What an incredible man you are, Chris. And we pray for a speedy recovery so that you can just live your life as you would like to live it in our free society here. Unfortunately, in the midst of all of this heroism, there has to always be a downside. Why? Why in the midst of tragedy do we have to get a lecture from our president about gun control? Well, the question is, are more gun laws the answer? And I want you to hear this report right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Short time ago, the president reiterated his call for new gun legislation. Correspondent Kevin Cork is at the White House with that part of the story.
For the second day in a row, a frustrated President Obama told the nation he would politicize the Oregon College shooting because it wasn't just a tragedy, it was a choice.
I'm going to talk about this on a regular basis, and I will politicize it because our inaction is a political decision that we are making.
The president blamed lawmakers he says are fearful of the powerful gun lobby for not doing enough to stem gun violence.
The NRA has had a good start, you know. They've been at this a long time. They've perfected what they do. You got to give them credit. They're very effective.
They've become all too common, from Newtown to Aurora, Milwaukee to Charleston, and now Roseburg, devastating mass killings by perpetrators who used guns owned legally. The White House is calling for more regulations, including background checks for all gun sales, a stronger ban on assault weapons, a ban on high-capacity magazines, and an end to the freeze on gun violence research. But are more gun laws really the answer? The president's hometown of Chicago, for example, has been besieged by gun violence despite having some of the strictest gun laws in America. The Windy City has had over 1,700 shootings this year, up 20% from a year ago, and 349 people have been killed by gun violence in 2015. Numbers that some on Capitol Hill say underscore the need for a more comprehensive approach to the problem.
There is much more to it than just more laws about guns. I say what we need is more laws dealing with those who are mentally ill.
Meanwhile, in Cleveland overnight, a 5-month-old baby was gunned down in a drive-by shooting. Police are searching for the killer and answers.
It's tough. This should not be happening in our city.
Absolutely heartbreaking to see that story. Tonight, the president has issued a proclamation ordering that all flags at government facilities be lowered to half staff. That proclamation taking effect immediately, and those flags will be flown at half staff, Brett, until sunset Tuesday night. Brett?
Kevin Cork, live on the North Lawn. Kevin, thank you.
The politicizing of this event in the midst of tragedy, of lives that are devastated and broken, is absolutely unacceptable. And as you heard in that report, Chicago has gone up 20% in shootings, and it has some of the strictest gun laws in the country. So that is a case in absolute fact, case in point, that shows that more gun laws don't solve the problem. It's people. And yes, I would agree with the laws against mental health. For those that have mental problems, we strongly recommend greater laws and greater avenues to reach out to these people. I would agree with that. It's people, not guns, that are the problem, obviously. I think that the whole case point of Chicago is a great illustration that more gun laws just don't solve the problem. But I don't want to take away from what I want to do this morning for these precious lives that were ended by this gunman. I want to pay tribute to them. This is a song by Michael W. Smith that I heard and I knew right away would be appropriate as a tribute to these nine lives that were killed in the name of Christ this past weekend in Oregon. This is a song called The Stand by Michael W. Smith. Remember what the gunman said, if you're a Christian, stand. And they did, unashamedly and unafraid. And this is a song dedicated to those nine in Oregon that took the stand for Jesus. Let's listen. An appropriate tribute to the nine who took a stand for Jesus. I want to share with you now a very appropriate story written by my great goddaughter. I'm talking about Paymeneh Sabet, who lives in Malaysia as an Iranian Christian refugee. You've heard from her before. I've read many of her stories. And when I told her about the content of my program today, she always wants to know what is my program going to be about so she can write something appropriate. She took this particular situation to speak about a larger problem. And, of course, she's speaking about the radical Islamists from around the world, which, like this gunman, are making our lives terrorized and unsafe. And so what I want to do, as I always do here on The Cross in the Desert, I want to read her story to you word for word. And as you hear this story, think about the nine who took a stand for Jesus. And think about our freedoms that are being threatened every day and our lives being terrorized and made unsafe. And what we can do about it is we need to take a stand. We need to do something to make life safer for us. But it's part of our discipleship, I would like to say, of being a Christian. It's part of our life. Jesus warned us that unless we take up the cross daily and follow him, we can't be his disciple. It's part of our discipleship. And one of those one of those consequences of being a disciple sometimes is the giving of one's life. Payman A. writes, "No place is safe anymore, neither the Europe, America, Canada, nor Australia. The story of the Middle East is the most highlighted one. Anywhere people go, there is a possibility of being shot or being taken hostage. In confectionery, in university, in the street, Muslims kill Muslims. Muslims escape from Muslims. Muslims go to Christian countries. Muslims kill Christians. Muslims torture Muslims. Muslims are tortured by other Muslims. And it all happens while the majority of Muslims are following Islam as, quote, the religion of peace. A lot of nice, good-hearted people believe in Islam and try to be a real human being. The problem starts when the minority want to be the perfect Muslims." Let's have a look at some, quote-unquote, perfect Muslims. The Islamic regime of Iran hangs a person every 2 hours, rapes men and women in prison to force them to confess, lashes people, stabs and acid attacks women, raids people's houses and causes pregnant wives to abort, and mothers have a heart attack from sudden fear. Thieves are mutilated, and all happens in the name of Islam. Every problem and disorder in the country is supposed to be by the leaders to have a root in Israel, the big Satan of America, England, and other enemies of Iran who are jealous and do not want this country to have divine features. In Syria, children have nightmares every moment of their life, and the cause is Muslims. In Iraq, Egypt, Libya, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and many Muslims are hurt and murdered by other Muslims. The minority of Muslims allow themselves to take the lives of the majority of their collegianists in the name of the religion of peace. I wish it was sufficient for them, but it is not. They want to dominate the world. They believe they have the right to abuse everyone's life. They simply go to candy stores alone and take tens of hostages. They simply go to universities and shoot at students and professors. They simply drop Christians in the ocean and drown them. They simply behead. They simply burn people alive. They simply hang. They simply betray the soldiers who are defending their country in the front. They betray the nation by changing the regime and betray the regime by helping the enemy who is the enemy of the nation and the whole country. They simply give vital information of that country to the enemy of their country, the enemy who bombards the house of their relatives. They simply give the information related to the coming war operations and locations only because they hate the regime, and the result is finding the bodies of 175 divers who were buried alive and tightened in the hands in front of the Muslim enemy and by the help of Muslim fellow citizens. They betray their fellow citizens not only in the name of Islam, but also in the name of democracy. They simply leave bombs in public places to kill innocent children. They simply raid their opponent's house around the world, stab them, and behead them. They simply do everything to take people's lives in the name of Islam, using verses in the Quran. Apparently, nothing will quench their thirst and satisfy them. Apparently, they don't know any limitation or borders. Apparently, their victims are not limited to a special group or social class. They want every place and every person unsafe. They want everyone dead. One person simply kills 9 educated people just after asking a request, "Is anyone among you a Christian? Stand up," and giving a news, "You're going to see God in just about 1 second," and then shot to death. He decides on the lives gifted by God, as his fellows around the world make a decision to kill. And people cannot find any place and any moment of theirs and their loved ones' lives safe. And still, Christians are nice enough to open the borders, welcome them to their countries, knowing that ISIS members are among these refugees as a serious threat for the whole residents as well as the tourists. And still, these big number of minority Muslims, the followers of the religion of peace, hate Christians and believe they deserve to die, that God hates them. And still Christians, who are considered non-believers by Muslims, believe that everybody created by God deserves to live and be loved because God loves everyone unconditionally. Well, thank you, Pamina, for another eye-opening article. And her whole premise is no place is safe anymore. And the radical Muslims continue to kill in the name of Islam. And this man killed, I don't know his complete background, but he decided that he was God and he could take their lives, these gifted, educated nine people who were going about their own business to get an education and make the world a better and safer place. In the name of evil, and this man decided to take their lives, but their lives count for eternity. They took a stand for Jesus, and they will be with Christ for all eternity. They win in the end. I want to say to their families, you are in our constant thoughts and prayers, and we thank you that the lives of your children will count for eternity, because they gave their lives in the name of their Lord and Savior, Jesus. Thank you, Pamina, for another eye-opening article. As we think about what's happening in the world today, just last week was the prayer rally, I should say. I shouldn't say that. The protest rally against President Rouhani. My good friend Danya Jam was there with her group of young Iranians standing up for hope and freedom. My good friend Pamina Shafa, who is going to be a guest here in about 24 minutes, also as a human rights activist and an Iranian-American, was there to protest against the Iranian regime and President Rouhani. And she's going to tell us in a half an hour what that event was like and what she sees as a hope for Iranians in the future. She's going to talk to us about the protest in New York that she attended last week. But in relationship to that, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also made a visit, and in his classic way of getting our attention, just like he got our attention back in March when he was here speaking before Congress, Benjamin Netanyahu, and you really need to see this to get the full effect, Mr. Prime Minister stood before the United Nations Assembly, and for 45 seconds of silence, looked at them in the eyes. His point was, you were silent and did nothing in light of this deal, knowing what they have planned to do to my people. But you have to see this video. It is incredible. But I am going to play what he had to say. This is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the United Nations just last week.
A few days after the nuclear deal was announced, he released his latest book. Here it is. It's a 400-page screed detailing his plan to destroy the state of Israel. Last month, Khamenei once again made his genocidal intentions clear before Iran's top clerical body, the Assembly of Experts. He spoke about Israel, home to over 6 million Jews. He pledged, quote, there will be no Israel in 25 years, end quote. 70 years after the murder of 6 million Jews, Iran's rulers promised to destroy my country, murder my people. And the response from this body, the response from nearly every one of the governments represented here, has been absolutely nothing. Utter silence. Deafening silence. Perhaps you can now understand why Israel is not joining you in celebrating this deal. If Iran's rulers were working to destroy your countries, perhaps you'd be less enthusiastic about the deal. If Iran's terror proxies were firing thousands of rockets at your cities, perhaps you'd be more measured in your praise. And if this deal were unleashing a nuclear arms race in your neighborhood, perhaps you'd be more reluctant to celebrate. But don't think that Iran is only a danger to Israel. Besides Iran's aggression in the Middle East and its terror around the world, Iran is also building intercontinental ballistic missiles whose sole purpose is to carry nuclear warheads. Now remember this, Iran already has missiles that can reach Israel. So those intercontinental ballistic missiles that Iran is building, they're not meant for us. They're meant for you, for Europe, for America, for raining down mass destruction anytime, anywhere.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is the only realistic person I know of that understands the heart of this Iranian regime. And he has to be standing there, I'm sure, the most frustrated prime minister in the world. And his silence for 45 seconds is to make a point. It is to say to you and me, this is your reaction to the success of this deal, but look at my people. In the Holocaust, they were systematically murdered, millions of them. And now we stand at the border, at the threshold of what could be yet another Holocaust, and you stand silent. You say nothing. You do nothing. Benjamin Netanyahu understands where the money for this deal is going to go. Money talks. That was the name of my last blog, and that's exactly what it is. Money does talk, and that's what this deal really is all about. It's not for the peace and safety of the world. It's for the enrichment of the mullahs and terrorism in the name of Iran, in the name of Islam. And it is horrible. The silence was deafening. I hope they got the point. But thank you, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You are a man of great grace. You are a godly man, and you are a voice of hope in the midst of absolute tragedy, deception, and terrorism. Thank you, sir. Well, as we think about what's happening with the nuclear deal, the protests last week in New York, the Pope being here, what on earth is Russia doing in Syria? Well, they're certainly not targeting ISIS because the number of people they've killed with airstrikes are all rebels. Syrian rebels working with us to topple the Assad regime. So what is Russia really doing in Syria? Let's find out from an expert, KT McFarland, right now on the cross in the desert.
This conflict, real estate billionaire Donald Trump saying to Charles Payne, our administration was totally blindsided.
I believe that I would probably get along with Putin. I think we might even have a decent relationship. But, you know, if you look at Putin and Obama, they're two people that just don't get along, and it's not good.
Well,
when he leaves here and then does what he did, it's sort of incredible. We were blindsided. Our administration was totally blindsided.
With me now, KT McFarland, former Reagan Defense Department Assistant Secretary. KT, so glad to have you with us on these matters. What is your first thought, Trump aside, I'll get back to that in a minute, on Russia, its strategy, and basically saying, we don't really care what you do, U.S., we're not doing it with you?
Well, the Russians have just run the table, right? The Russians have just totally outsmarted and outfoxed Obama at every step. And it's a lot more than just, well, they were so much smarter, cleverer. The Russians are now in a position where they're going to take over the Middle East. Because, think about it, Monday, they go to the U.N. and they say, America, this mess in Syria is all your fault. And by the way, your anti-ISIS coalition is a fiasco and it's a joke. On Tuesday, the Russians announce their alliance, which is Russia, Iran, Iraq, Syria. On Wednesday, they send a three-star general, goes into the American embassy in Baghdad, and says, you got an hour to get out of Syria, the bombs are starting.
Yeah,
we're going to drop bombs.
Basically barking orders at the U.S.
Barking orders at a young U.S. defense attaché. That's not just like a diplomatic slap in the face. That's like a punch to the jaw. So the Russians are telling us, you get out, we're here to stay. We're ramping up. We're putting our own military forces. And if you want to be here, fine, but we might get you.
Okay, so, KT, I am assuming Russia is doing this because the U.S. did put sanctions on Russia as punishment for Crimea, punishment for Ukraine. So is this Russia's way of saying, okay, fine, you tried to put us in the corner, you tried to marginalize us, guess what? Not only are we not going to be marginalized, we're going to be in an area that is key for you, U.S., and for your safety.
And for the world economy. I think the Russians are, Putin, I mean, he's just fascinating to watch, right? I think he's quite predictable. He's trying to restore Russian greatness. Russia used to be the major outside power in the Middle East until the early 1970s. Then we replaced them. Putin wants that back. We used to be the major power. We won the Cold War. Putin wants that war back. He wants to win.
I was just
going to
ask you, do you think he is provoking a Cold War?
Oh, I think he's in a Cold War. I don't think he ever thought the Cold War ended. He didn't think we lost the Cold War, that we won the Cold War and he lost. He thought, well, maybe we're a little bit behind, but we're catching up now. Now, here's what I'm watching, okay? Several things. One, is there going to be an incident in the Middle East? I mean, the Russians have told us, get out of the way, we're here. We're now flying in the same airspace, U.S., Russian aircraft.
I feel like we're already in a proxy war.
What happens if somebody shoots down an American aircraft or an American drone? The Russians can come and say, oh, look, you know, it's an accident. We didn't really mean it. We told you guys we were going to be operating there. You should have gotten out of the way. What is our response then? Who knows? The other thing is, if I'm going to pick your pocket, Deirdre, I'm not going to tell you which pocket I'm picking. I'm going to tell you to look over there. What happens if the Russians are now trying to do something in Ukraine? I think this is their golden opportunity. Europe is distracted economically and by the refugees.
By the migrants, yeah.
Yeah, by the migrants. We're distracted by the Middle East. This would be an opportune time for Russia to make a move in eastern Ukraine.
So in this particular way, precisely, you agree with Donald Trump, it seems like, in that the Obama administration essentially got scooped. Blindsided.
Totally blindsided, but I think willful blindness. President Obama personally just thinks that somehow if America steps back from the leadership role in the world, that its global community is going to rise forth and world peace will ensue. Putin looks at this and says, you guys want to step back? Fine, I'm filling that vacuum.
KT, so glad you're here. KT McFarland,
thank you.
Joining me there, former Reagan Defense Department Assistant Secretary.
I think KT is right on target. I think Putin wants to restore the greatness of Russia. Who knows exactly what's all the reasons he's there? We need to watch this as it develops and keep you informed. The Middle East, the world has become an incredible place here lately. With all that is happening, it's hard to keep up with the reasons why and what's going on. Last week, I did a special program on Sharia law and the Constitution and what some Muslims that are citizens here are saying about Sharia law in relationship are opposing the Constitution. I want you to hear this very insightful special report of what's happening in the UK and how Muslims are dominating that society there in the UK. This is eye-opening, and I want you to hear it.
So do you feel that you are British?
I identify myself as a Muslim. If I was born in a stable, you know, I'm not going to be a horse. If I was born in Nazi Germany, I'm not going to be a Nazi. I mean, this is just an island I was born in.
Ramesa and Chowdhury both live in East London, which is home to one of the largest Muslim populations in the UK. In one part of town, Ramesa and his associates have set up so-called Sharia patrols to go out and discourage behavior that they deem un-Islamic.
There's some guys there.
On this night, they stopped to talk to a couple of non-Muslim men who were in a park drinking beer, which is forbidden under Islam.
So we're just reminding the community about staying safe. And in this area, there's a lot of gambling that goes on, a lot of alcohol drinking, and it leads to a lot of problems. So we advise you, and we advise anyone you see, to stay away from these things.
Get the prostitutes off our streets!
But the patrols are not always so friendly. Online clips give a very different picture. A woman in a short skirt is abused.
Vigilante
cannot dress like that in Muslim area.
I'm so appalled.
We don't care if you're appalled at all.
Muslim patrol. Muslim
area. It's Great Britain.
This we don't care. It's not so Great Britain.
You need to get out of here.
A man the patrol thinks is gay is insulted.
Get out of here quicker then. You're dirty, mate. You're a gay, mate. Get out of here, mate.
The night time, it turns into a very ugly place like many of the...
Walking through London with Ramesa, you experience an alternate reality where there is no compromise and all conversations are one-sided.
Ultimately, I want to see every single woman in this country covered from head to toe. I want to see the hand of the thief cut. I want to see adulterers stoned to death. I want to see Sharia law in Europe. and I want to see it in America as well. I believe our patrols are a means to an end.
The only thing I would say is that in America and in the United Kingdom, democracy,
a backwards one,
but it's a system
one.
That allows the people to choose what they want and allows people freedom.
So why can't I choose Sharia? When in Rome, overthrow Caesar, implement the Sharia.
In your home, you can do whatever you want.
But what about in the public? Why can't I tell you to cover up? Am I free to say that?
Because it would be outrageous.
So where's my freedom? Where's my freedom?
You can say it to me, but
okay,
you...
so cover up. Wear the hijab.
That's absurd.
The thought of Chowdhury's supporters taking the law into their own hands is deeply frightening to most British people. This is a group that believes the West is at war with Islam and that the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan justify any kind of violence in response. The most shocking example of that logic was the gruesome and very public murder of British soldier Lee Rigby on a London street last year.
We have killed this man today is because Muslims are dying daily by British soldiers.
On that day, the man wielding the knife was a known associate of Chowdhury. Chowdhury has refused to condemn Rigby's murder, nor will he criticize ISIS for the beheading of American journalist James Foley and other Western hostages.
You know, I don't know the details about James Foley.
I know the details. Let me educate you, because he was a friend of mine.
I don't believe you, I'm afraid. Sorry, I don't believe you.
You don't believe me that James Foley was a journalist.
I don't believe any Western journalist, quite frankly. I believe you're liars until proven otherwise. But let me tell you something. The perspective of the Muslims of journalists, whether that be James Foley and others, is that they are the propaganda for the Western regime.
Have you formed an opinion for yourself?
I form my opinion on the basis of what the Muslims say, not on the basis of what you say.
I'm sensing a double standard here, because essentially you're very quick to condemn acts of violence by the West, but you refuse to condemn any act of violence by your fellow Muslims.
No, I believe that there's a difference between the oppressor and oppressed.
It's unbelievable. Chowdhury is an extremist. Even some of my Muslim friends denounce him as being representative of peaceful Muslims. And of course, there are those that are peaceful. But this man has done more harm than good. Speaking out, he's a representative there in the UK. Can you believe this? Muslim patrols, Sharia law patrols telling women to cover. But, you know, we look at that and we go, oh, my gosh, that can't happen here. Oh, yes, it can. Oh, yes, it can. And this is the goal of the extremist radical Muslims, to overturn our democratic freedoms, our constitution. They would want to have Sharia law as the law of the land wherever they are. They want to dominate. They want to take over. That's very obvious from here. And you may say, well, that's a few extremists. But wait a minute. We're allowing refugees in this country. How many extremists are mixed in with those refugees? Could this be what happens in the near future in our country, that we have Sharia law patrols? A question for you to ponder. Just recently, I had the wonderful privilege of being a guest on Narges Ghaffari's radio program, Radio Arava. She has been doing radio, Narges, for over 20 years in Ottawa, Canada. She's an Iranian Canadian, and a very, very nice, sweet lady, and a very, very knowledgeable lady, being a voice for Iranian people through her radio program. I recently was a guest on her program, and this is the interview that we had just last week. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
My guest today is Mr. Randy Noble, a Christian author and host of a radio program called The Cross in the Desert. I contacted Randy a while ago after I heard his interviews with Iranian activists around the world. I was intrigued to hear an American radio host not only is interested in Iranian issues, whether it's human rights or politics, but gives them time and opportunity to tell their stories. I spoke to Randy about his published book called The Cross in the Desert and his upcoming book, which is about Rehane Jabari, a young girl who was executed last year on October 25, 2014 in Iran for defending her honor against her rapist. Her rapist, Murtaza Sarbandi, was an Iranian intelligence agent. Hi, Randy Noble. Thank you very much for accepting my invitation and thank you for being so patient with me.
Thank you, Narges.
Tell us, what is the name of your book, Randy?
The name of my book is The Cross in the Desert, subtitled Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran.
So it's very interesting for me to see an American Christian writer and radio host to write and talk about Iran and Iranian people's situation. What made you write this book, and I want to know especially why did you dedicate it to Rehana Jabbari?
Well, to answer your first question is the video of Neda Sultan being shot by Basiji in the alleyway in Tehran in the 2009 presidential election. Mm-hmm. The video that everyone around the world saw was the reason why I began speaking up for Iranians. It had such an impact on my life. And I only found out later, Narges, that her name, Neda, means voice calling. And I really felt like that's when my calling began. The reason I dedicated my book to Rehana was I became aware of her case through some other human rights activists who are Iranian, and I began to follow this case with great interest, and I was so devastated that the Iranian regime would even think of putting to death a woman who defended herself against a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a month before this execution, I would spend nights in the chapel at the work at the hospital just praying for Rehana. praying for something good to come out of this, and of course it didn't. And I felt that I wanted to do something very special for her family and for all Iranians, so I took a picture of her and put it on my book and dedicated my book to her.
And as I understand, you are actually writing a book about Rehana, am I right?
Yes. One of the things I wanted to do when this happened, I wanted to somehow get in contact with her mother, Sholeh, but she doesn't know very good English, so through an interpreter, she sent my friend a request, and we've become very good friends. And she is actually sharing a lot of valuable information about Rehana with me, so I can write something very positive about Rehana and to answer all the critics, because I think that Rehana is a symbol for the oppressed people in Iran. And I just want to write about who she is and what she stands for. And so I'm writing a book called Rehana, A Beautiful Fragrance, referring to her name, meaning flower and fragrance.
Mm. Randy, I want to know your impression of Iran and Iranian people in general before Neda Aga Sultan.
You know, I didn't know a whole lot about it, other than the fact that the government held hostages back in 1979. And like everyone, I wanted to know why this happened, and it was just a thought I had. And really, I thought nothing about Iran very much until the 2009 election.
And what do you think of Iran now?
I love the Iranian people. They're gracious, respectful, hospitable. I'm just driven by the passion they have for democracy and freedom. And the fact that they are just some of the most respectful people I've ever talked to. A lot of them on Facebook, I'm friends with them, and we Skype quite a bit. We talk on Viber, and I just have such a passion to be a voice for them.
And why do you spend so much time advocating for freedom of Iranians, Randy?
Well, it all links back to Neda, and it all links to the events that are happening in Iran when I see how women are treated, mm-hmm. how they're treated like second-class citizens, and I see Iranians thirsting and hungering for freedom and coming here. I want to help them all that I can, so I try to be a voice for the voiceless. I try to put petitions on my Facebook page to speak up for their human rights and help them all I can in a practical way, like with the English language. I will spend time talking with them and helping them with their English and in practical ways, but I want to help them for them to live out their hopes and dreams and not to be under this oppression.
And how do you get them to trust you and open up to you, Randy? It's really important point, I think, because the Iranian regime has crushed the trust of Iranian people. When they connect to people, it's very scary because it could have dangerous consequences for them.
Right. It's a very scary situation. One of the first things I do when I friend request them is speak in their own language, the little bit that I've learned, and tell them that I'm their friend, I'm not their enemy, that I don't think Iranians are terrorists. I try to explain to them I don't see them as terrorists, and I explain to them why I want to be friends with them. And a lot of times, because I have other Iranian friends, it's easier now than it used to be. But I take that approach. I try to break down the stereotypes and let them know that I'm an American that cares about Iranians.
Mm. And could you tell us what is the American people's impression of Iran after the nuclear deal? Do they differentiate between Iranians and the regime at all?
Well, here's what I'm trying to do, Narges. I have book signings where I hand out stories of my Iranian friends to help them distinguish between the true Iranian people and the government. And one of those postings is in my book. It's a story by Al-Razu, who says, Iranians are not terrorists. They are your friends. And I will hand this out to people and say, look, here's what real Iranians are, and here's what the government is. And I always show them the difference.
And when you talk to people, I'm sure you have talked to a lot of people. I read your book, The Cross in the Desert.
Uh-oh.
I saw that a lot of people have contacted you and you interviewed them. And I just want to know, how do you decide which one to publish? Because they are so different and they're all so moving.
That's a good question. One of the stories in there is about Mehrnoush, and her story was particularly intriguing because of the way women are treated and because of how her husband treated her and abused her and how she went to court and the judge even upheld that you're property of your husband. I thought that story needed to be told so that people understand what women are suffering from in Iran. And so I published stories based on their situations like Mehrnoush. I want my readers to understand how women are treated. So that's one of the reasons why I selected her story.
Mm-hmm. And Randy, what is the name of your radio program and when does it air?
Well, my program is by the same name. It's called The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. It's every Monday and Thursday at 9:30 a.m. Central Standard Time.
Do you have any website people can go and listen to your show?
Just go to my page in Facebook called The Cross in the Desert, and there's a list of podcasts of my radio program.
Great. Thank you so much, Randy, for this, and thank you for taking part in echoing Iranian people's voice for freedom.
Well, thank you so much, Narges, for having me as your guest.
Well, what a gracious lady. I'm going to have Narges on my radio program in the near future. She's a fascinating person, well-educated, doing a great job being a voice for the Iranian people on her radio program, which is every Sunday, 3 p.m. her time in Ottawa, which is 2 p.m. our time here in St. Louis Central Standard Time. Her program is called Radio Arava. She has different guests. I'm going to learn to get to know her better and her programs. I want to have her on because she's a veteran. She's been doing this for about 20 years and just a superb lady, a real delight to talk to and have an interview. Thank you so much again, Narges, for that interview. I have a very special friend right now I want to introduce to you. Peymaneh Shafi is a human rights activist, Iranian-American, who lives in San Francisco. And every July, she goes to Maryam Rajavi's National Council on Resistance of Iran. It's an annual gathering in Paris. But she's also very active on her Facebook page, posting about the plight of Iranians for freedom. And she is a good friend, and I welcome her today to The Cross in the Desert. So happy you could come, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert, Peymaneh.
Hello, Randy. Thank you so much for inviting me again, and thank you. Greetings to your audience, and also I would like to congratulate you on your anniversary. I read it on your Facebook page and just wanted to give you a belated happy anniversary to you and your wonderful wife.
Well, thank you so much, Peymaneh. I'm glad that she was able to share me with you today on our anniversary. We had a great weekend, went out to a real nice dinner together. It's been 14 years, and I'm really, really a happy guy. But she does the same thing I do. She's also a radio person, and so we understand each other's kind of careers. And so we have to work today, but we're going to be together at least for a few hours.
Well, that's great. And send my regards to her and congratulations as well. Thank you for inviting me for today's program.
Thank you, Peymaneh, for being a guest once again. You've had a very active summer. You went to the annual Paris gathering with Maryam Rajavi, the National Council of Resistance to Iran, and that's an annual gathering where you talk about the issues in Iran, you address the situation, you make a plea for a regime change. And then just last week, you traveled from San Francisco to New York to be part of another national gathering here of Iranian Americans standing up against the visit of President Rouhani to the United Nations. I want to ask you about this event, but what do you think, Peymaneh, first before I ask you that? Did it shock you when our government sat down with the Iranian regime and approved this deal? Was that a shocking event for you? What did you think?
Well, you know, it was shocking to me because it had a deal. Not that I don't want to see a deal. It would be the best thing to see a deal going between, shoving a potion of poison to Ayatollah's mouth because of their, past 30 years of hidden activities as far as the nuclear program goes, and make them to stop this vicious program. The problem I saw with this deal, and a lot of people saw with this deal, was the way it was implemented, and it had so many flaws. And you know, they got Ayatollahs by the throat, made them sit on the negotiation table, but unfortunately, this deal was too lenient on the Ayatollahs, and it didn't address many issues that a lot of us, as far as human rights advocates, see it. There were a lot of issues that it could have been addressed, and it didn't, and it really, really bothersome to human rights activists, such as myself.
Right. I was thinking of the scene I saw on the internet over the summer of a young Iranian street child who was found dead inside of a cardboard box. One of the drivers of a car had mistakenly run over him. There is so much poverty and job loss and economic woes in Iran. People are hurting on the streets. And all of this money from this deal, payment A, won't go to help them, will it?
Absolutely, absolutely not. And the sad thing is, about it is, you know, as you mentioned, poverty and all of that, you know, during sanction, Iranian regime lobby were advertising that there are no medicine for Iranians, they're deprived of this and that, and all these medical attention because of the sanctions. But I guess the highest number of import to Iran was luxury cars. I mean, it's all up to the Ayatollahs of what they want to import inside Iran. They don't care about people. You know, in the province of Khuzestan, which is the most richest as far as the revenue goes, because all of the oil and gas lines are there, so it's one of the richest provinces of Iran. It's the most poorest place of all in Iran. In fact, just last night, I saw the news of a young man who committed suicide over the grave of his father because of poverty and not having, enough food to eat or job or things like that. So because of the economic pressure on people that it's caused by this nuclear program, they're spending so much money. You know, they spend so much money on this program, not for this sake of people, not to have nuclear energy, because Iran is such a rich country as far as gas goes and other alternative energy goes. They can very well manage to bring some alternative energy to Iran. In fact, they didn't spend a dime on current technology for their gas lines and all these, you know, technology they could have spent right money where they can, you know, much cheaper they can produce energy for Iran. So it's very well clear why they went after nuclear. It's very clear from the day one that they lost the war in between Iran and Iraq. They wanted to somehow be advanced in their military weaponry in the region. And it's completely clear what their ultimate goal was. And we can see ever since the nuclear negotiations, at least 4 or 5 major, I mean, these kind of events, if it was any other country, U.S. invaded them by now. I'm talking about Bahrain, Kuwait, Yemen, and Lebanon. All these smuggling, and also Iraq, smuggling of weapons, terrorist activities, invasion, helping terrorist militias, all these horrible event that is taking place in Middle East is all caused by a enormous cancer which erupts from Iran.
Yes, I was reflecting on what you were just saying. When Khomeini seized power in Iran and ousted the Shah in 1979, one of his statements was, "I will export Islam to the world." And that's exactly what they're doing through all their tentacles and all of the money. I saw the picture of the young man bleeding to death over his father's grave. It was just heart-wrenching. And I also saw a picture of a man out of work hanging outside of his apartment dwelling in a city in Iran. This is the mood of despair among Iranians. This deal has nothing to do with human rights. And that's why you went to New York just last week to join other Iranians and to say no to this regime, that it needs to be replaced.
Exactly. And I tell you, as an Iranian, and most of us Iranians, are not going to settle anything less than a regime change in Iran, because we know this regime, for past 30-some years, it has passed its, all sorts of exams throughout the years that it cannot be moderated. It cannot change within. It needs to be changed completely in order, to get democracy and prosperity for Iranian people. We cannot deal with these thugs that are running our country. And the guy, Rouhani, who is responsible for executing 2,000 people just during his tenure, and also he has been responsible in death of thousands of political prisoners in Iran past 37 years, and he was directly involved in sham negotiations with the U.S. and hidden program of nuclear program. He deliberately deceived the world, and he said it many times on televised TV in Iran that he has deceived the West to continue their vicious nuclear program. So this person does not represent Iranians. Don't be deceived by his looks and smile. And he's a criminal. You can see that top advisors of his, interior minister and, a couple of other ranking of his cabinet are murderers, IRGC members, and terrorists that are very well known to Iranian people.
Yes, and you hear lots of stories, by the way, about the Ayatollah being in serious health. And it would seem to me, Peymane, that Rouhani esteems the greater position, that he would like to become the new Ayatollah, the new supreme leader.
Well, there's always struggle between these Ayatollahs who want to control power within themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you can, if you listen to their discussions in parliament and they're within inside newspaper, you can see how much difference these guys are having between themselves. But their ultimate goal, when it comes to their ultimate goal, they know they have to save the regime. So they all have that unified together. But within themselves, it's just power struggle, and they want to control, the wealth that is, Iranian people's wealth, all those kids off the streets that they cannot feed themselves.
Mm. Now, one of the things that I saw when I saw some of the pictures from the protest rally in Iran, and by the way, in New York, it was so well put together, so well professionally done. I cannot believe that it didn't get the attention of the world. But one of the big signs was, "Say no to Rouhani, 2,000 executions." Now, you think about that. We go back to the August time when he became president in 2013. Since Rouhani became president, it seems like every 7 hours there's an execution. And there is no reform, as he promised. There is no lessening of the laws, as he made mention of. There has been, on his watch alone, as the banner said, the yellow banner, 2,000 executions, and they're continuing.
Absolutely. And these are the ones that are, recorded, and we are aware of them. God knows how many of, people have been killed, and nobody knows about it. And also, keep in mind, the highest violation of women's rights, done under Rouhani. Never forget Rehana Jabari. Her anniversary is coming up, and I really appreciate the phenomenal work you have done for Rehana and other Rehanas. It's amazing.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for that. And as you remember, the acid attacks on women, the case of the Kurdish girl who was sexually assaulted and had to jump off the hotel in Western province
Arizona.
Of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There are just so many cases against women under Rouhani's watch. And it's amazing that, when they had the happy song that was performed with some young kids in Iran, within hours they arrested, flogged them, and they imprisoned those kids. But after acid attacks, so many cases, not even one person was arrested, and not even one person was, put in justice. Where is justice in Iran?
There is no justice, and this is why people like yourselves, Payman A, are so valuable. We appreciate you so much because you have taken your time and freedom as an American, and you are using your time and your energy, and you've not forgotten your people. There are Iranians that live here that assimilate into society, and they forget about their people in Iran. But you and Donya and so many others, I could name a list a mile long, you are relentless pursuing hope and freedom for your Iranian people, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
Well, we owe it to people like you who gives us inspiration and support us like this. When I went to New York rally, I saw so many enthusiastic and great supporters from all over the United States. I cannot thank them enough, all these friends that they gathered there and participated in that rally. I wish, as you said, people were more conscious about their country. And don't forget them. I mean, this is a privilege we have in the United States, freedom of speech, that we can use for our people back home and be their voice. And unfortunately, a lot of people forget that. And, another thing is that the Ayatollahs have made people so afraid that they even are afraid to talk in the U.S. Look at their lobbies. Look at their, all these... when you go on social media, you see how much propaganda is for Ayatollah. That makes them a little bit scared. And I want to tell my fellow Iranian Americans, don't be scared. Don't be afraid. They cannot do anything to you. They can't do anything to your family. Use your freedom of speech for your people and don't forget them. So
that's exactly right.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, you talked about, in the beginning, you talked about how Khomeini, in the evolve of revolution, had said multiple times, multiple statements, and that's his legacy of exporting its revolution to the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I want my American friends, all my friends know that that is what we are talking about when we're talking about Iran's terrorist activities. They want to export the way their ideology, and they wanted to impose that on other region, and it's going to hit home, which has. I mean, I've seen footage of what they've done in London, the protests that they have, the influence they have on, peace groups. Unfortunately, our peace groups have I don't know how they can fall for this.
Mm-hmm.
If you are anti-war, if you are pro-peace, and you want world peace in this region, you need to follow a regime change in Iran. That's the only way possible to have peace in whole Middle East and all over the world. And this chaos, chaos of extremism is going to just be all gone when you don't have this state sponsor of terrorism in Tehran.
Yes,
in power.
This is very important that you talk about these different groups that are influenced, because Iran, the regime, they're very clever. They can manipulate peace movements, and their propaganda is cleverly funneled to get their ideology out among the masses. They try to use threats, and sometimes they try to smuggle in spies that will work with you. They have a lobby group, NIAC, in Washington, that is working on their side. So they're trying to do everything they can to squelch the freedom of Iranians that live here, and as you pointed out, try to put terror in them so they won't speak up. But as you rightly pointed out, Payman A, we have freedom of speech here. And it's something we have to fight for, because radical Islam is making its inroads via Tehran all over the world. I had a report on this program of Muslim Shiite patrols in East London trying to impose Sharia law on those that are not Muslims. So this continues all over the world.
Exactly, exactly. And I will send you some research that's been done by various people. They've done enormous effort on this to expose the Iranian regime lobby of how they operate in London, in Italy, in Europe, and also in other Western countries. And it's amazing, and I don't know why this blind eye is on State Department. And they get the State Department. They endorse people like Trita Parsi, and I'm really, really disappointed of our government. What kind of message are you giving to Iranian people? I just before I talk to you, I read this comment by one of the I have a lot of respect for this gentleman who does a lot of research on Iran. He said about Russia's invasion of Syria that, you know, what kind of a message are you sending out, that Russia is going to be an ally of the dictators, whereas U.S. is going to just forget you and desert you. And that's the reality today. And that's not what our forefathers fought for. They fought for democracy, and they stood by Europeans when Hitler was invading Europe and committing all these horrible acts. United States stood tall, and that's the policy should be, defending democracy, not ignoring and deserting freedom fighters, as they did to people of Ashraf and Liberty.
Yes, I agree with you. I wanted to ask you, in your travels and as you go to New York, how do you find that American people are responding to the Iranian people? Are they beginning to see how gracious, respectful Iranian people are as compared with the government? Are more Americans that live here beginning to get an understanding of the situation with the Iranian people, their desperate plight for freedom? How are they looking at you now?
Well, actually, it's very kind to see that Americans have been so respectful towards our movement and towards our resistance. They are amazed, they are supportive, and so inspiring. And I'm just, you know, I cannot thank my American friends, the American, all of my supporters and all of our supporters, that they, when they see this kind of spirit, they're just all for it, because they know American people have experienced democracy, and they know how valuable it is, and they don't want to lose it in their own country. And they, when they see injustice somewhere else, as it said, injustice everywhere, anywhere is injustice everywhere, and they live by that, and they see that, and they have a great respect, and I cannot thank enough my American friends to be such a gracious supporters and such, you know, I mean, they're such an inspiration, and I really appreciate that.
Well,
just
and we
people
really
like yourself.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you, Peymaneh, and many other Iranians that are fighting so hard for this battle. And I thank you that you had a time to speak with us today on the Cross in the Desert. One day, very soon, I believe, Peymaneh, we're going to see an end to this regime, and all of our hard work and our speaking out and praying is going to make a difference, and we're going to see some hope and freedom for the Iranian people. I believe that's coming soon.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. And one more thing that I want to tell my fellow Iranians is that change is going to happen. You better be on the right side of the history.
Yes.
And
yes.
Also, you know, we're fighting for democracy. We're fighting for freedom. That means whatever ideology you have, as long as you respect democracy, you respect human rights, you are with us. Don't think
Amen.
That you are a part of Iranian resistance. Everybody who loves Iran, who respects democracy, and who loves to see that all these injustice disappears or is with Iranian resistance. And I value every single one of the people who were in New York rally. I know how much effort they put in to be there. They had to take off from their jobs. They had to spend money on their ticket. They had so many problems they needed to take care of as far as their job, kids, school, work, all together. Despite all of that, they were there, they were present, and they were so organized, and I'm very proud of every single one person who was in that rally. It was amazing. I wish you were there to see the positive energy and, you know, and see all these young people who are, you know, Iranian regime always had this propaganda, oh, these are all old-minded people, and things have changed. The young people aren't after this, but you were in the rally. You see this young energy. It gives you inspiration, and it gives you hope that this is going to happen soon, as you said.
Amen. Some good words from you, Peymaneh. I agree with what you said. It's going to happen very soon, and thank you so much for sharing your passion and what you're doing for the hope and freedom of Iranians. Thank you so much for being a guest today on The Cross in the Desert.
Thank you. Thank you for...
Thank you. That was Peymaneh Shafei calling all the way from San Francisco. I'm so sorry if I cut off your last word. Didn't mean to, but my time is evaporating here, unfortunately. But I want to thank you as well for listening to the passion of Peymaneh today and her story of being a fighter for freedom and democracy in Iran. Thank you so much, Peymaneh, for your time, for your effort, for your dedication for your people. And today, as I end The Cross in the Desert, I want to thank all of my guests also in the chat room, from Patricia to Shirin and everyone that was there today. And I want to leave you with this song by Michael W. Smith today, and remembering the Oregon Nine who gave their lives for the Lord today. Let's end the program today with The Stand. God bless you.